What are the similarities between the founders of Islam and Mormonism? The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April is The American Muhammad, Joseph Smith, Founder of Mormonism. It's written by regular guest Dr. Alvin Schmidt. You can purchase The American Muhammad by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040, or you can find out more at issuesetc.org. The American Muhammad, The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Only boys can look after the parents. They are the only ones who can perform the last rites. They are the only ones who will continue the family lineage. If all that is there, then why will anybody want to have a girl child? And also on the top of that, you have to pay dowry.
Places like Uttar Pradesh, Bihar, Odisha, which are becoming more prosperous, where there will be greater availability of technology and more incomes in the hands of families, they will tend to shape the family and sex select.
That's Ranjana Kumari of the Center for Social Research and Ravinder Kaur of the Indian Institute of Technology, both speaking recently on PBS Religion and Ethics News Weekly about sex selective abortion in India. This is something that we hear about. Is it cultural? Is it religious? Is it something that's coming to the West? Is it something that is built into the culture of the religion, of Indian culture and religion, in particular, Hinduism? Joining us to talk about sex selection in India, Pastor Stanish Stanley. He's pastor in the Indian Evangelical Lutheran Church and a PhD candidate at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Pastor Stanley, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you very much, sir. It's really nice being with you.
Is there something in Hinduism as a religion? I know it's also very much a culture, but is there something in Hinduism as a religion that speaks for or against this practice in India of sex selective abortion?
Well, it's a very difficult question to really answer. Hinduism as a religion itself, as you rightly pointed out, it is also a culture, but it is also based on a lot of texts, especially ancient texts. The general understanding, especially the Hinduism that we talk about today, the modern Hinduism, which also picks up a lot from India's own rediscovery with Hinduism as a result of its dealings and engagement with British rule over India, and especially in its interaction with Christianity through the mission enterprise which was taking place in India. We could say that yes, there are things which could be taken as pointing out that sex selection, or for that matter, the killing of female babies, for that matter, or any fetus, for that matter, is at least to some extent, prohibited within Hinduism. It is not to be done that way. For instance, let's take Mahatma Gandhi's own understanding that life is sacred. It is all about, Hindus are supposed to practice ahimsa, non-violence. It is not supposed to be a killing religion. It's supposed to be tolerant, you see. So all those ideas can easily be used to understand that killing of fetuses or killing of a life, if it is done in the way it is being done, is just wrong. It is not right to do. But also, as I said, there are texts. Hindus believe in ancient texts like the Rig Vedas, the Upanishads, and things like that, and books and texts like that. And there are, at certain places, there are mentions of, especially in the Rig Veda, there are mentions that you've got to protect the baby in the womb. You cannot destroy it. It is almost it is tantamount to killing one's own parents if you were going to do something like that. So there are texts along those lines, but the sociocultural practice of Hindus is completely different from what is out there in the texts.
So let's talk about Indian culture. What is it about culture, especially with respect to the value, so to speak, that is placed upon women as opposed to men, that would lead many Indian families to engage in sex selection?
Well, Hinduism as a system, as a way of life, looks at the life cycle in the following way. That is, that as a child, the child is under the control of the parents. And in this case, it is the woman, if we are specifically talking about females. The girl child is under her father in her young age as a child and as she grows up into her teens. Once she gets married, then she is in the hands and in the control of the man with whom she is married to. So, and then she lives a life as a housemaker. She basically lives with the family of her husband. Because we are talking about joint families, families within Hinduism more than the nuclear families as it is understood here in the West. And finally, when the husband dies, and let's say that it's in old age and the eldest son is in a responsible position having married himself, then he would be the one who would take care of his mother. So the basic understanding is that females within the Hindu system are seen as dependents. They are basically depending upon their fathers in their early part of their life, then their husbands, and in old age they basically depend upon their eldest son to take care of them and to tend for them. Also, the other side of it is that it is. India is a poor country. Now, of course, things are changing, no doubt about that. But at least till the late 90s, we were considered to be a developing nation. And with considering the socioeconomic aspects of poverty, it is very much easy to understand that taking care of the girl child becomes secondary to taking care of the male child, who will be the breadwinner for the family. So, given all this kind of understanding, it is very easy to kind of conclude and also understand where the entire sociocultural practice of considering women as secondary citizens comes from within when you take into account the Indian way of doing things.
So, if it's only in terms of what it costs the parents, the mm-hmm. the daughter's considered to be in essence a financial liability on someone, either mm-hmm. a father or a husband, or the rest of the family, if she has neither. She's going to cost you money. Is that a kind of crass way of saying it?
Very true. Yes, that is the not only the crass way of saying it, but I guess this is the practical way of saying it. Because for most Indian parents, that is the way they look at things. I wouldn't say that it is the same situation today with majority of Indians, because as I pointed out, as a result of the Christian interaction with Hinduism, British rule, the educational system that they set up in India, things have kind of changed. But at the same time, especially when you go to the rural parts of India, and which was at the time of independence, India was supposed to be 60% in the villages, and now it has probably changed a little further towards urbanization, But given that, keeping that in mind, we also understand that most of the people who live in the rural areas, who come from that kind of an outlook, do find women to be a burden for their family, economic side of life, especially because they cost money. You know, you've got to pay dowry when they've got to get married. You've got to take care of them. Of course, she's a homemaker, but there is one Hindi word which kind of makes or sums up the entire thing. They say in Hindi, "Ladki paraya dhan hoti hai." That means ladki, girl, is the wealth of the outsider. She is the dhan, the wealth of the pariah. That means the outsider. So she is basically somebody who you are just investing some money in her, and she's not going to give any returns back to you, basically because she's going to get married and she's going to set up the house of some other guy, who of course, by virtue of being marrying the girl, becomes an insider to you, but still, she basically carries on the lineage, the family, of the person to whom she is married. So she is considered the outsider's wealth for no benefit of your own. So,
how much does the practice of the can you explain what the practice of the dowry is in Indian culture, and how much of it do you think influences decisions like this on the part of parents?
Well, dowry, it's a very difficult thing to answer, especially because some of the Hindus would claim that there is no real talk of dowry within the Hindu system. Especially there is nothing in the text, the Hindu texts, or for that matter, it is just a sociocultural practice. But at the same time, we see that in the laws of Mannu, for example, who is supposed to be the greatest lawgiver of the Hindus, there is definite mention of the girls being controlled, the girls forming a part of the family, and that is basically their life. Their karma is associated with the dutiful fulfillment of her duty as a wife to her husband. And in that context, when she goes to another person's family, when she is married off, she has to have her own dhan. She has to have her own money. And that is what is called as stri dhan. Stri means woman. Dhan means wealth. So she basically carries off her wealth, which she has in her family, into the family of the man to whom she gets married to. And this has, over time, become a big problem, because within India, whether it's Christians or whether it's Hindus or whether it's Muslims, in India, stri dhan, dowry, has become a normal thing for everybody. So it's of course the overarching Hindu cultural, socio-cultural framework within which dowry is understood and practiced. But even the other guys also participate in it, as I pointed out, the Hindus and the Muslim, the Christians and the Muslim Indians too, have some form of dowry, which is kind of given as gifts in most cases today, because dowry is banned in India. But at the same time, it has kind of captured the sociocultural imagination of India. Anybody, any girl getting married today would demand her part of the share of the property. Earlier, it was not that way. Earlier, it was that the other side of the family would ask whoever was getting married, hey, you've got to give my wife share of the property, and that's her stri dhan, dowry.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about sex selection in India. Pastor Stanish Stanley is our guest. It's Tuesday afternoon, April the 9th.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the logo for the Issues Etc. Journal and Weekly Bulletin insert at issuesetc.org and sign up to receive the Church Bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. Issuesetc.org, look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo, and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
Did you know that Logia, a journal of Lutheran theology, sells CDs and audio downloads of teachings by some of the top Lutheran theologians in the country? Check out Logia's 99-cent download of the month at shop.logia.org. Shop.logia.org. You'll also find books published by Luther Academy and, of course, the quarterly Logia Journal at shop.logia.org. Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran, shop.logia.org.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers, you're listening to Issues, etc.
In the 1500s, the Reformers grieved over the view people had of their callings in life, believing work done for the church superior to work done anywhere else. So the Reformers worked to restore a proper balance. But as it's written in Ecclesiastes, there's nothing new under the sun. 600 years later, with the thought of everyone a minister, haven't we gone back? The CLCC has released a new seminar on the doctrine of vocation, an important Lutheran teaching that has fallen into disuse over the years. The solution is to start teaching it once again. The seminar contains four lessons, with a standalone overview lesson available for circuit convocations. Serving our neighbors through our vocations is essential for the task of evangelism practiced according to Scripture. Contact us to schedule your seminar today at theclcc.org. That's theclcc.org. And please, consider joining the CLCC or making a donation to help us bring these powerful but low-cost seminars to the laity. theclcc.org.
Once people reach the higher rungs of the middle class, which I call the stable middle class, they don't sex select. Then they tend to view girls and boys as being of equal value. So they don't really care whether they have two girls, whether they have one girl, one boy, etc.
That's Ravinder Kaur of the Indian Institute of Technology talking about how things change depending on economic circumstances for families in India. And we're talking about sex selective abortion in India. Pastor Stanis Stanley is our guest pastor in the Indian Evangelical Lutheran Church, and he is a PhD candidate at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Can we do some comparing and contrasting? How is it that you said, first of all, even among Christians in India, the dowry is considered kind of the socially acceptable thing? It's ubiquitous, although it is outlawed. Is there any kind of should there be a Christian qualm of conscience for Indian Christians about not so much what the dowry is, but what it says, what it affirms in Indian culture about women?
Well, there is definitely a difference. First of all, let me say that it is not viewed in the same way as how Hindus would view dowry within their kind of socio-cultural lifestyle and living. For Christians, in most cases, it is considered as a property of the woman that the woman brings to her husband's family. But it doesn't mean that some of the evils that are found within the problems faced by women with dowry do not exist within Indian Christian setting too. Of course, there are wife beatings or violence, and there are things along those lines which happen because sometimes the woman doesn't bring sufficient dowry to the satisfaction of her in-laws or of her husband. But in most cases, at least when you look at the missionary side of Indian Christianity, I don't think the missionaries were really happy they do not really encourage practices such as these. But it is something that has always been there. It has kind of continued and continues even to this day. But it's also today within a context of more education coming, and Christians are supposed to be the more educated group of people in India compared to their Hindu and Muslim counterparts. For them, dowry is not seen as dowry, but it is seen as probably as something of a gift that they get from the woman's side. But as I said, it's very difficult to kind of answer a question like that, especially because when we know what is happening because of dowry within our Hindu friends and near and dear ones, we understand that Christians are also kind of following that practice. And of course, there should be a conscience clause. We have to question these things, but most of the time, it is just taken as a socio-cultural practice and does not have any religious connotations to it. So that is the way we, probably the Christians, kind of just manage that out.
How would you describe the basic differences between the Christian view of the family and of girl children, the place of women in society, with that of the Hindu culture?
Well, for Christians, as I said, it is more. They are basically the products of the British educational system. So the understanding, and also the fact that within a biblical Judeo-Christian worldview, the understanding that we have is that both man and woman, are made in the image and in the likeness of God. So there is a sense of an egalitarian message which is already deeply entrenched within that kind of an understanding that we go with. So when you look at a Christian family, basically there is an emphasis upon both the male child as well as the female child being seen on equal terms. So education is not curtailed for the woman or kind of kept away from her, especially because Christians believe that it is the duty of the father and mother to hope for the best and to do the best for their children. And that is what they would do even if they are Indian Christians, for that matter. But on the other side, within a Hindu setup, it is more seen as I mentioned before, Of course, education is provided to the women, especially now within the stable middle class that you kind of pointed out in that documentary that was there. With more money and with more education coming in, our Hindu friends are also doing the same thing. They're also making it possible for their girl child to get educated and you know, behave and also have access to many of the things that the males have. But overall, there was one time when even studying together, male and female sitting together, was a problem, because within the Hindu system, it is the female is supposed to be chaste. She is supposed to be virtuous. She is supposed to be loyal. She is supposed to be faithful to only to her husband. She cannot even lift up her eyes and probably look at another man, lest she might probably end up having enticing the other man. So within that kind of a sociocultural understanding, it was more difficult for a Hindu family to probably let their girls get more educated, also see them as equals with their male children. But now with education, with the English education especially coming up, things have changed on their side too. But as I said, for Christians, it is more within an understanding that we are created equal, on equal terms, in the image and likeness of God, that probably helps us to understand that our responsibilities and our roles to both men and women are the same. So it's the same for our male child as well as for our female child.
How is that, can you tell us, how is that the Christian worldview received in Indian culture? How is it understood or regarded in Indian culture?
Mm-hmm. If at all there is a big difference which is taking place within the Indian culture, within Hindu culture for that matter, it is definitely because of the role played by Christian missionaries through the schools that they started, especially in the late 18th and 19th century when the British ruled over India, and also the early 20th century. The educational system through the missionaries, especially the colleges and the schools that they started in the urban areas and also in the village areas, kind of made a difference in setting about a chain of reaction within the Hindu elite, especially the Hindu elite, who realized that things were not going to remain the same, because a major portion of India, especially the lower castes of India, would flip over to something like Christianity. So they were terrified with that, and they realized that they had to kind of change their own understanding of their own religious beliefs. And in many ways, there was a rereading which took place of their own scriptures. There was a rereading of their own superstitions, and many of those superstitious elements and many of their own religious ideas were reformulated as a result of their interaction with Christian missionaries, who were always on the attack against their caste practices, against the way in which they looked down upon women, especially the role played by women missionaries from the Christian side, who opened up opportunities and who for girls' education, for also for healthcare, medicines, and medical missionaries, the role played by them. And also, very importantly, there was something called as temple prostitution, which used to take place, the Devadasis of India. They were... That particular system of organized temple prostitution of female girls was very severely attacked by Christian missionaries. And the role played by them basically led to the British in sync and in league with the elite Indian Hindu leaders who were on a reformation path, worked together to get things in place so that the modern India that we do see today, the modern Hinduism that we talk about today, could come out of it. So if at all there has been change, it is definitely because of the interaction with Christianity. And that for me is, or for all of us, is basically something to be proud of, and also to be brought out into the forefront to say that, yes, Christianity has made a dent. It has made changes within the Indian way of life. Maybe people might not accept it or understand it, but it is there. It is a reality that everybody has to accept.
Pastor Stanish Stanley is pastor in the India Evangelical Lutheran Church and a PhD candidate at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Pastor Stanley, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you very much, sir. It was really a pleasure being with you. Thank you.
The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April is one that deals with a remarkable coincidence, and it turns out it isn't that much of a coincidence, as it is kind of a natural parallel. You may not make the connection between Islam, one of those world religions like Hinduism, and Mormonism, something that is quite well known by us here in the American West. But there is a connection between the two, especially in their founders, their personalities, their modus operandi, and their beliefs. And that's the subject of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for April, called The American Muhammad, Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism, unveiling parallels between two self-proclaimed prophets. It's written by Issues, Etc., regular guest Dr. Alvin Schmidt. You can find out more at our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find The American Muhammad on every page of our website. Just click the link and you'll find out all that you need to know. Browse before you buy. Or call Concordia Publishing House and order The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for April, The American Muhammad. 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. When we come back, it's Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. It's Tuesday afternoon, April the 9th. We're going to spend the first part of Hour 2 talking with Dr. Jennifer Romack Morse, getting her reaction to something that Bill O'Reilly and Megyn Kelly said on Fox News about same-sex marriage. They are both for it. They both don't see any real reason, real good reason, real compelling arguments being made against same-sex marriage. Their reaction is kind of, what's the big deal? Why are we so worried about this? How is it going to hurt anyone else? We'll see what Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse has to say in response. And then we'll talk about whether or not Easter is a pagan holiday with Pastor Joseph Abrahamson. Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. in 5 minutes.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Islam, worship, feminism, pietism, postmodernism. You can meet and hear Issues, Etc. regular guests discussing these topics at the Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Registration is $100 per person. The Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14 and 15 in Collinsville, Illinois, issuesetc.org.
Those beautiful notes were just the beginning of We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, Concordia Publishing House's debut CD collection from Pastor Stephen Starkey, one of the most significant Lutheran hymn writers of our time. For a limited time, save 10% when you use promotional code URA. Simply visit cph.org today. Lutheran thought, Lutheran substance, Lutheran music, brought to you by Concordia Publishing House.